Let's go. Let me tell you something. Let me tell you something. Yeah, it's a get down on the ground again. You know they wanna get us in the pound again. It's a get down on the ground again. You know they wanna get us in the pound again. Only out here with my friends trying to do me. The police have declared that I can't be free. Any semblance of joy that they see. Boy must have gone on a killing spree. It's a get down on the ground again. You know they wanna get us in the pound again. Sweat me, woo. But they got me. Get down on the ground again. You know they wanna get us in the pound again. It's a get down on the ground again. You know they wanna get us in the pound again. Think I look like a criminal? Wanna send a message that's subliminal? Cops must control made just to limit you. So let it all go. Only God get into you. It's a get down on the ground.
This is Tongue in Cheek Assembly.
I'm whipping in the Impala with my friends. We do a donut on the count of 10. We never thought about it while they shooting at us. Then we gonna catch it just like this a plug. It's a get down on the ground again. You know they wanna get us.
This is Tongue in Cheek Assembly. I'm joined today. I'm gonna pass the mic over to Assembly fellows Amir, Akram, and Daryl Santana. We're here also again with Sean Leonardo and ghosting in the room are two other Assembly fellows that worked on these exercises with Amir and Daryl, Jeremiah, Romaine, Latham, Butler. So they're here in spirit. And I'm just going to describe a little bit of what we're going to be hearing and doing today. Utilizing a series of visualization and embodied exercises, Assembly Youth Fellows invite you to challenge your preconceived notions while developing a historical understanding of policing. By collectively imagining and learning solutions for conflict, we hope to create a community that is able to establish safety without the use of coercion, policing, and violence.
All right. Hi, guys. It's nice to be here with you guys today. It's a pleasure to be hosted by Tim and Tom on the mixer. But today we're talking about a bit of what Recess's overall and arching projects have been, especially with us fellows who serve as youth artists, printmakers, writers, and just community organizers. The goal of these community safety workshops have been to establish an abolitionist and anti-policing framework in our community. We've really been aiming to work with the Red Hood Justice Center and the youth that they have on their premises from their own backgrounds, mostly from court diversions. But along with them, we aim to explore what it means and what is possible in a world where there doesn't have to be policing, in a world where we're all armed with the knowledge, maybe with de-escalation, maybe with just prior learning. And just working along with youth and arming people to know that they don't need police in order to be safe in their communities.
Yeah, the workshops emerge out of really the principles of our practice at Assembly, which, just to give a little more background information and retrace where we were just a little while ago together, Tim, situated at Recess, which is a nonprofit arts-based organization in Brooklyn. And 7 years ago, the Assembly program was founded as a court diversion, both in the misdemeanor and more recently in the felony charge space, and has since expanded to a more broad philosophical notion of what diversion is, thinking about the overlapping systems of harm and oppression that our young people experience in their lives. And the community workshops that we will attempt to translate over the air for you as an audio experience emerged out of our felt experiences specifically over the course of the summer of 2020 and the murder of George Floyd, in which the necessity of thinking about alternative models of existing in the world really felt present in our lives. And so, without over-explaining the exercises that we'll traverse listening, visualization, and embodiment. We're just going to go ahead and launch in. Yeah, Tim?
Yeah, great. Thanks, Sean.
Right on. So, Daryl, you want to walk us through our first listening exercise here?
Yeah. So our first listening exercise is basically we're listening to two different songs right now, and what we want to do is basically visualize the type of person that we are being presented right now. It could be whether how they look, it could be personality traits, it could be circumstances that led them to sing about the songs that they put out. So
let's start with the first, yeah? Let's withhold the introduction of what the song is and just go into it, yeah?
Mm-hmm. So we'll go with the first one right now.
Mama, take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark, too dark to see. I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. Mama put my guns in the ground. I can't shoot them anymore. That long black cloud is coming down. I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door.
When I listen to this song, the type of person I'm visualizing is a man within, like, in between, like, his mid-20s to, like, early 30s. I would assume that, like, they are in the police force or at least involved with being a cop. Personality traits, I wouldn't really know how to really distinguish that, but part of me feels like they are kind of like easily influenced or like they follow the crowd around them. So this is, but they don't necessarily have a backbone for themselves, if that makes any sense. Overall, like listening to this song, that these are like the things that I'm visualizing in my mind, because I would mention the not having a backbone, because I would feel like most of the things that they are talking about in this song would not be from like their own volition of their mind, but maybe like a pressure of their peers around them or like somebody higher up who could, you know, jeopardize anything that they have going for them at that certain moment. So that's what I kind of pick up from this song.
Do you want to go into the second song right away and see what other visuals come up for us?
Yeah. Here we go.
Smart. Big brr.
Turn me up, YC. Turn me up, YC. Turn me up, YC. I got my own. I don't need security in the club. All they wolfing on the net. I thought you was a thug. I ain't got nowhere to go. I
shot up everywhere they was. Yeah, you know who took that from you. Come get it back in blood. Come get it back in blood. We ain't mask up, no Dodger X. Know who it was. It's story like the 80s. Want something back, get it in blood. Yeah, you know who took that from you. Come get it back in blood. If your killer ain't dead, you should wear no RIP shirt. We had 300 shots up in the car before we picked up dirt. Who ain't got? Going, go grab a glizzy, get alert. Shots to G-Post, RIP, and Breezy in the dirt. Brr, you gotta know I go too far. Got two O's up on this honey, one of them might stand for O Block. About 20 some shots left up in the K, 15 still in the Glock. Keep my door unlocked and stop, I like getting on feet, park the car. Brr, we get no clothes, do them dirty, I ain't showing love. 11,000 all ones, left my right pocket in the club. These blue faces up on me dirty, I went got it out the mud. If I took some, get it in blood, I don't give a fuck where we was. I got my own, if I don't need security in the club. All they wolfing on the net, I thought you was a thug. I ain't got nowhere to go, I shot up everywhere they was. Yeah, you know who took it from you, come get it back in blood. Come get it back in blood. We ain't mask up, no Dodgers, know who it was. It's story like the 80s, want some back, get it in blood. Yeah, you know who took it from you, come get it back in blood.
Killed your man, you keep on talking, better get that in blood. Give my shorty Nima dub, then they gon' walk inside the club. Hit his little with that switch, I bet that switch switch up his nerve. The ops inside my city, little bro, put them in the mud. You can't come back to your hood, huh?
No.
He was dissing on my cousin, now his all in that wood, huh?
Boom, boom, boom.
Book his, I wish he would come. V-Roy pop up out that car with that new Glock, I wish he would run. His plan, I'm really icy.
Really icy.
Pooh Shicey, that's my dog. But Pooh, you know I'm really shy. You told all them OT that you really sly. Tell the truth about your game, they really die.
I got my own, if I don't need security in the club. All they wolfing on the net, I thought you was a thug. I ain't got nowhere to go, I shot up everywhere they was. Yeah, you know who took it from you, come get it back in blood. Brr, 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 come get it back in blood. We ain't mask up, no Dodger X, know who it was. It's story like the 80s, want something back, get it in blood. Yeah, you know who took it from you, come get it back in blood.
Now listening to both of these songs, can you imagine what upbringing both of them, both of these artists came from to form their viewpoint to make the music that they put out?
You know, when you look at it, when you listen to it, initially you think of someone, even just genre-based, you think of someone from a place where country folk music was listened to, a softer side. They were more exposed to the instruments and the musicality. They had a bit more opportunity. They weren't alone in there, but they still made their choices. As we mentioned earlier, that lack of backbone kind of led to them following a crowd and going down a negative path. However, they made the choice. In this second scenario with this next singer, Pooh Shiesty, you listen and you almost feel like their environment didn't dictate them, but they had to dictate their environment. They go into their world with the aggression that they need to not be left behind, with the power and strength that they need in order to be more dominating, because in their environment, you get eat or get eaten. You almost, the way they might interact with their community might be heavier handed versus the person from the initial song being someone who falls into it and is almost on defense. These are the kind of notions that come to my mind most naturally when I hear these songs put side by side.
You know, what's interesting is that if you pay attention, if you deeply listen, violence is prevalent in both songs. The way it's communicated may be very different in terms of how explicit the language is. And yet, when I hear you and what you're articulating is that the way that the messaging lands with us feels differently, particularly because of the aesthetic of music. But I'm wondering, just so we're clear with our listeners, like, where is violence evidenced in each of the songs? Like, with what lyrics for you all was that captured?
With the Knocking on Heaven's Door song, I believe that the evidence of, like, violence was when Bob Dylan was basically pleading with his mother that he didn't want to do that anymore, and how he wanted to bury the gun. Like, that right there kind of indicated, like, something happened that was pretty traumatizing to them and made them realize what they were doing wasn't really the right thing to be doing, and now they're questioning their, like, decisions that they've made so far. It's kind of like forgiveness, but, like, it's forgiveness, but you can't, like, really forget, like, what happened. Like, you know you did something wrong, but you can't put it behind you. Like, you have to take accountability for it.
Yeah, you use two really important words in our reading of that first song: forgiveness and forget the first thing that you said, but it was both forgiveness and that the fact that the actor, that the protagonist is traumatized. And I was going to shift it over to you, Tim. I know you wanted to chime in. Is it implied in the second song that those two words might be present? Something like forgiveness and traumatization?
I guess for me, kind of combining some of those reactions might answer that. I keep thinking about the trill in the second in relationship to, I can't do it, so I'm not going to try. But the trill in relationship to also what Amir was saying about the sort of environment, conception of environment, and when a voice is creating that environment versus, like, musicality in a different way that doesn't have to do with voice creating that environment. And so I was kind of putting those together, thinking of, while you were both speaking now, saying, well, what is in those two different things, what do we perceive as the source of violence, right? Where is it coming from? One's own environment that one is creating, which I don't think is the right direction necessarily to go with it, or is it something, you know, is somebody maybe corporally a part of that violence, or have some sort of structured separation from it?
That's right. And so I guess the question that then emerges in our sensitivity to listening to either song: are we more inclined to feel victimization in one character over the other?
Even as I look at my own response, I'm forced to recognize that the most natural thing to me is one where someone, the first song being that Bob Dylan one, the first song is someone that is affected more by sadness. And in that sadness, they seem to be, they're not conceived as criminal. They're not held responsibly for what they've done, even though their badge that they mentioned gave them the power to shoot people, which they've done so much that they can't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point.
That being one. But then with Pooh Shiesty, you almost, it's like you're trained. You have a natural preconception that's telling you this is an aggressor rather than a suffering person.
You say trained as in we are trained as a listener. Is that what you mean?
Yes. And not even simply as a listener, as I hate to say, a member of society, where societally we are looking at someone who is deemed as criminal versus someone who is deemed as a doer of a crime. I think those are two very different labels. You've committed a crime versus you are a criminal.
And I would even say, by extension, because we're given so early in the first song the suggestion of authority while putting the badge down, that we immediately start moving into a space where that character, that protagonist, might actually be connoted with heroism. And so the duality of the songs that both have violence present and yet were ingrained to perceive them so differently based on the messaging of heroism versus criminality is very much the departure point for everything that we're going to do today. And so what I would suggest to the listener and the conversation that you'll hear us have is a triggering, no pun intended, of how we are so ingrained with particular messages that are accompanied by visuals. And so what we will attempt to do with the upcoming exercises is really problematize how we read our environment and therefore react within that same environment based on how we've received and internalized preconceived notions of criminality, and more importantly, who is criminal, who is perpetrator of violence. But before we do any of that, or before I should say we continue on in this path, we're going to actually move into more of a historical context. And we'll still approach it via an exercise. And in its original form, Daryl actually created what we're about to listen to, but in the version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. But so you won't get any of the bells and whistles of the game show delivery in this iteration. But we do want to provide a sort of historical foundation for how we discuss policing moving forward.
With this game, I've done a pretty sufficient amount of research to compile this together. I feel like education behind certain topics is good for learning how to dismantle systems, so to say. So in this exercise of me researching the NYPD, it was basically like a look back on like one of the laws of power, where they basically tell you, like, you know, they say to know your enemy, you have to, like, you know, study them. So in this case, like, we were trying to break down these systems of policing, but how can you break down systems of policing if you don't know how certain things came into play? So the first question that I have here is, what is the name of the law which allowed the creation of the police force? And for our multiple choices, we have A, the Municipal Police Act, we have B, the Safety Act, and then we have C, the Police Act, and then D, the Crime Stopper Act.
So let's let our invisible audience marinate on the multiple choices, yeah? Mm-hmm. Could you say the four choices again, Daryl?
The Municipal Police Act, the Safety Act, the Metropolitan Police Act, the Crime Stopper Act.
And this is which law instated originally the New York Police Force?
The answer would be A, which is the Municipal Police Act.
So to give a bit of the context behind the Municipal Police Act, this was instated in May 1844. And the Municipal Police Act actually came with a lot of controversy because it was fought for literally between two separate police departments. They were attempting to vie for control because of the fact that even in the beginning of the institution of police, this was the first police department ever developed. That's why this act in and of itself is revolutionary in a way, in a not so good way. But without this one, around this one, it was an extreme amount of corruption because the first mayor, Mayor Woods at the time, he was taking an extreme amount of payouts in order to enable one prior militia, more militaristic police force to exist versus one that the law was trying to instate due to the fact that they recognized his corruption. Now, of course, when we're talking about corruptions in police forces, this is something we're going to dig into more later on. But the reason that this act even came to be in the first place was because the influx of German and Irish immigrants into New York State. Now, this was happening versus the previous colonizers that now felt this was their home. These were Dutch and English people. But when they saw the culture and the lifestyle of these people coming into their communities, they felt the entire fabric of American society was falling apart.
Sounds familiar.
Right. Now, this is a straight quote from Britannica Encyclopedia. They're saying middle class frustration with the deterioration of cities had led to the passage of laws regulating public behavior and creating new public institutions of, here's the fun part, social control and coercion. I don't think I have to dig in too much to say how this applies today.
Let's highlight those words. Tim, I see you writing notes over there. Coercion, control, behavior, public behavior at that. Yeah.
The second question is, why was the NYPD established? And the multiple choice answers to this one is A, to make sure there is order. B, rising crime due to Irish immigrants. C, to protect businesses. And D, build revenue for the city.
Could you say those again, Darryl?
Why was the NYPD established? A, to make sure there is order. B, rising crime due to Irish immigrants. C, to protect businesses. Or D, build revenue for the city.
Even with Amir's background context, I'm having a hard time answering that question.
To be honest with you, the answer would be B.
Which is?
The rising crime due to Irish immigrants. The NYPD was established in the early to mid 19th century due to rising crimes with increasing population from Irish immigrants.
Can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. What do we think about the words due to?
Due to?
Yeah.
It's already like a prerequisite for me. Like, it already feels like they already put this in place knowing that, because Irish weren't really an accepted group either. So when you look at like black folk and Irish and Italian people, they were all kind of in the same boat.
Now, I find this question extremely intriguing because of the fact that when I hear due to, I don't think of the person in public saying, I don't think of the police commissioner announcing to the people, this is why we're doing it. I think of the HR, the PR departments behind their backs telling them, this is what's going to get you the most support. This is what the people that we care the most about are saying is the problem. Mm-hmm. And because they think it's the problem and because they are discomforted by it, we need to take this course of action. I don't think they would ever say that we are creating this due to the fact that these immigrants are coming in. They would never say that. They would say due to rising crime rates. They would say due to infrastructure problems. It would be some sort of coded language that would never unveil the true reason behind it, striking fear into a certain group of people and
their control. Their true reason. Right?
Yeah, sure.
Their construction. I mean, that's what I find really interesting, what you're saying, is their construction of reality, right? The HR's construction of reality, and then the ability to make a public appearance with that language.
That's right. And in that construct, whether real or perceived, the messaging therefore presumes that crime, as it's categorized lawfully, did not exist before the arrival of these two immigrant populations. And so therefore, we now have a police force.
If there's anything that I can add, I think it's important to note that this happens not only for the police, this happens on the whole political spectrum. Presidents have had, let's say for example, Bill Clinton's running for presidency. he's the first Democrat to win after a string of Republicans winning. The thing that got those Republicans so much support, says his campaign managers, they took a tough on crime approach. Tough on crime means, coded language, holding down the black and the ghetto communities, the Latinos, everybody that is plaguing where we live. Now, what he does, he takes on the three strike rule, something you wouldn't hear a Democrat doing prior. They were perceived as too soft on criminals, not people who commit crime. They didn't see the war, drugs and the infestation of the community as a public health problem. They saw it as a criminal issue. And now taking this approach led to him being more favorable.
Third question that I have is, the Lexon Committee, the Knapp Committee, and the Mullen Committee were all to A, investigate corruption in the police force, B, gather information for cases, C, protect police, or D, persecute citizens. The Lexon Committee, the Knapp Committee, and the Mullen Committee was all to A, investigate corruption in the police forces, B, gather information for cases, C, protect police, or D, persecute citizens. And the answer to that one would be A, to investigate corruption in the police force. In the 1870s, the police were taking bribes for illegal liquor sales and voter fraud. The Lexow Committee was established in 1894 to investigate corruption in police departments. And in 1970, the Knapp Commission was also created by John V. Lindsay to investigate systematic corruption in the force. In 1992, Mayor David Dinkins appointed the Mullen Commission to investigate corruption in the departments. The same year, Dinkins created an independent civilian complaint review board. It didn't land well, and it caused police to riot and protest.
So, Mayor, what are you extrapolating from the fact that we've now know about three different commissions on police reform?
One, I would love to have a moment to laugh at the fact that this has brought police to riot once again. Meaning, before our first question, the Municipals Act, we had two different police forces, the Metropolitans and the Municipals. One was appointed by Woods corruptly for money because they paid him in order for them to have jurisdiction and power. The other one was the law, the state above him establishing it. Now, what did it lead to? A riot between cops. It was referred to as the Great Police Riot. Now, literally 100 years later, another committee is formed, or a committee is formed to investigate problems that was initially there, corruption. 100 years later. And what does it do once again? Police riot. I think it takes someone a lot, it gives someone a lot of anger. I'm just going to put it like that. When you recognize the Lexon Committee really happened when they were recognizing that police commanders were making what is now worth millions of dollars just because they got personal business connections with the biggest businessmen in the city in exchange for favors. Meaning, whatever you need to get away with, go for it. We could compare this to lobbyists now. Alec, a huge, if you've watched 13th, the Ava DuVernay documentary, you've heard of them. American Legislative Exchange Council, which already, legislative exchange sounds really suspect. I'm just going to put that out. But once again, we see that there is a strange thread in industry, politics, and law enforcement. It's almost like a trifecta, a triad that continuously learns to mask itself.
I kind of see it like taking candy from a baby sometimes. The last question that I have for you guys is, what act was enacted after the 2014 death of Eric Gardner? A, the Police Protection Act, B, the Brutality Act, C, the Garner Act, or D, the Chokehold Act? And the answer to that one would be D, the Chokehold Act. On July 17th, 2014, Eric Garner was killed by NY police officer Daniel Pantaleo through illegal use of a chokehold. On June 8th, 2020, both houses of New York State Assembly passed the Eric Garner Anti-Chokehold Act, which provides that any police officer in the state of New York who injures or kills somebody through the use of a chokehold or similar restraint can be charged with a Class C felony and punishable up to 15 years in prison. And now that we know the history behind the NYPD, do you think there was a moment in place where things would have went better or worse if a certain action didn't take place in this timeline?
Hard to imagine it getting worse.
Yes, I sort of hear that question as a trick question. Intentionally, and I think that's where you're pointing, Daryl. And actually, I want to withhold my response in terms of like how I perceive that trajectory or that historical legacy and bring you in, Tim, and ask you why you think we, Daryl in particular, have given you these particular moments in the emergence and expansion of the NYPD, which are actually what's being presented here, these key moments in the creation and militarization and expansion of the NYPD. For you, those particular points which we're tracing, how does that resonate for you, or what is that communicating to you, rather?
I guess I did find myself always surprised by the answers, because I kept picking ones that I presupposed were self-protecting of the police, or self-serving, or like most vocally self-serving. So I guess to answer that in a certain way, like ones that were, I think even the due to one, right? Was that the due to one, right? And I thought at first, I was like, oh, that it had something to do with a monetary gain for the state or something. I was just like, prepared to see that the corruption from the beginning. But it makes me, what it does bring up, hearing those three together without necessarily being able to coherently tie them all together, is just all the different structural facets that are involved actually in it. I don't want to say it's not like the showmanship of it, but like just all the different kinds of activities and different legislation and enormous amount of things that are going on to manage this thing that is already trying to manage, what did we say, social behavior, right? I think that's the thing that comes up, is how structurally how structurally confusing it is. It is like, it is like if we look at the history or hear the history of policing, it is almost like the string of all of those multiple choice questions, or all the multiple choice answers, not the questions, that we're like kind of confronted with.
That's right. Part of what occurs to me is, and I hope I'm picking this up correctly, Tim, it's almost the notion of too big to fail. That if the purpose of the police force is social control, and it is disguised in language, and yet it's the institution is developed and expanded based on that purpose, no matter what historical precedent, you still return to that historical fact. No matter what emergence or shift in legislation, you still Because when we move from each question, when we move from, and then learn the historical context, it's almost as if we're repeating the same question in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like what, you know, we talk about legislation of reform twice, and we talk about the ways in which the police force was given purpose or reasoning. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, in each historical step, we're masking its origin. Mm-hmm. And the clarity that we need to regain is the fact that the police force was put, was instated for a very particular reason, the control of bodies. And it should therefore be no surprise that with three different committees examining corruption, mm-hmm. and then later the ways in which or the law or legislation that was placed after the murder of Eric Garner, which we should clarify did not lead to the criminal prosecution of any of the officers, because it was never in court categorized as a chokehold, that each step, and therefore by extension the ways in which we continue to call for reform, will only ever disguise its origin as a force, and we use that language purposefully, a force to control bodies. And yet we still buy this ticket in which we externalize our own notion and necessity for safety to a force that applies restraint, that contains and controls. Mm. And yet we only understand the police force as something that contains crime, not people. And so when we move into this space of thinking about something like defund the police and the backlash that occurs after that you know, legislative push, we immediately fall into this reaction of, well, what do we do about crime? Mm. Rather than talk about the ways in which the police were never actually in place for reasons of crime. They were always instated to control particular bodies. And when we get to that clarity, we start to think about, therefore, how crime is perceived as responsible, or a responsibility of certain bodies, meaning that the perpetrators of crime are specific people, mm-hmm. types of people. And when we push it even further, we gain the clarity in which we understand how blackness is assigned to criminal. And we're going to continue on this thread in the ways in which the historical foundation and this information that we now sort of gain clarity in terms of how the police force evolved and expanded and the reasons that it were instated to begin with, how that masking goes a long way into the messages that are ingrained within our psyches and bodies in the first exercise. The ways in which when we perceive criminal, we mask that fear, that sensation that is charged through our body, that visual, that image of criminal, we replace immediately with a justification for controlling crime. And what we therefore do not do is grapple with the ways in which we are seeing a particular body as criminal. And how the NYPD continues to mask their purpose has everything to do with the way that we become so able to be manipulated by the fear of crime. And we're never, therefore, having a conversation about social control.
like throw like another piece of like historical context?
Yeah, go
like,
for it, Darryl.
Back that one up. yeah, you could even see it when it comes even in like the forms of like the historical context, because like Amir mentioned earlier, there was two different it was modeled after the London's police force. So they had two different types of forces, which was the municipals and the metropolitans. And the metropolitan people, like the metropolitans, they were the ones who dictated over the Anglo-Saxon and, you know, those type of people. And then the municipals, they were the ones who were over the, you know, the group of the Irish immigrants, Italians, and, you know, blacks. So when you think about it, like, when you think about the municipal part of it, a lot of them were barely even trained. Like, they weren't trained like that, so they kind of just threw them out here into the world. And, you know, when you look back into, like, why they got upset about, you know, all these laws being passed, it's like they feel like their moral obligation is, like, being taken away from them. Like, I don't know, I feel like they think this is the way it's supposed to go. So seeing how the things were, how these like forces were modeled, it already gave me like a type of historical view that like seems pretty cyclic to me, where I'm like, you see it happening often and often, and it's kind of like weird how things still manage to happen even though you have all these laws in play. So it's kind of like, you know, you're in on the law, but you also know your way how to loophole around it. So it's kind of like you have like a double-edged sword when it comes to like policing.
I just want to ask a couple questions to spark talking a little bit about assembly.
Of course.
I guess maybe in a first way, I would love to hear from the two of you, and or one of you, in your own words, how you would define and describe assembly.
I've always felt like assembly is a sort of familial adjacent. It's a place where young folks who have been through a lot and are going through a lot are able to find redeeming qualities in themselves and to take advantage of those and to find the opportunities that are going to help them become the best version of themselves.
I feel like assembly is like really multifaceted when I think of it. In the terms of like it being a art gallery, art space, a lot of the work that we do, like, it aligns along with art, but it's like, it's nice to see how we take different forms of it, like performance art, for example, or like how we do screen printing at work, or like the different artists and like the ideas that they come in and bring, they present to us. And even like now with us, with our abolition workshops and stuff like that, it's like, I don't know, in a sense, it's like different than most art galleries to me. Like, I don't know, a lot of art galleries feel like they just showcase art. And with us, like, we're just bringing art into like our everyday conversations or like everyday like perceptions. So I don't know, I find it to be like a nice like space and outlet to actually be able to create, but also be able to be around like-minded individuals, so you could like bounce ideas off of each other on how, like, you know, to make solutions for our future.
And that's both artists that are coming in particular to Recess, which is like the hosting kind of organization of assembly, and also artists that are coming specifically into assembly, I guess.
Yeah, like we got the peer leaders like us, and we have like, you know, the session artists.
Okay.
They have like their things. Sean is also an artist.
what does it mean to be a peer leader? Like, or it's called a fellow, right? That's different.
Yeah.
It's the same.
They're actually different.
All of the young people that come to us all go through at least a 4-week curriculum. And that conduit is either the court system or a peer referral, or an organizational referral. And so there are a number of reasons why a young person might come to us. But it all, what we try to do is start from a place of care rather than obligation. So throughout the curriculum, what we're really looking at, is this narrative revision work that mm-hmm. This is very much a product of the community safety workshops. Mm-hmm. How do we reinscribe how we look at ourselves and therefore how we've internalized all these messages of who is criminal? But to answer your question directly, at that point, you self-select to stay on or not.
Okay. And once you've selected to stay on, then you become a peer leader.
Exactly. And then at which point you're paid for your engagement with recess. And the fellows follow a longer, deeper track.
A peer leader is like being a student that's able to absorb so much of the world of recess. And I feel like I can say the world of recess with a bit of like confidence, because it's like it forms its own ecosystem and economy of care and support. It's a place where, people actually do take the time to listen to you. It's a place where you can have those arguments about, I think it's this way. No, I think it's this way. And then find your middle ground. It's a place where you're exposed to more and more and more and more constantly until you get a better idea of what you want to be mm-hmm. or who you need to be engaging with or what communities you need to act in.
And a fellow?
Oh, and a fellow is taking that a step further, where you've gone through the cycle of being a peer leader, which is about a 9-month cycle, and certain people who have shown that they want to work even further in the arts. They need to have more specific goals. They need to have more targeted engagement. This is our step in our time to find out what we want. Tell them, this is exactly what I need. This is exactly who I am and who I want to be. And get internships, be involved in projects, and get tutelage on how to get there.
What is the day-to-day? I mean, you mentioned, Daryl, you mentioned, like, session artists. But, like, what are those sessions?
When I first started, we were, everybody was doing Zoom. So, when I first came in, like, that's, like, the entry into it. Just, like, learning, having these sessions, but also having, like, the initial, like, opening sessions would be, like, almost like our track two. I mean, not track two, track one with Camilo, where he does, like, art history. So during that first, like, beginning, that's kind of, like, where we were leaning towards. But, like, we were also, like, in the first iteration of it, we were kind of, like, also stepping, like, touching upon, like, abolitionist thing, mindset along those lines. When we speak of tracks, this is, like, basically different electives. So okay. The first track is, like, our history. Mm-hmm. Our second track is, like, us actually doing, like, we're the doers. So screen print shop, things like people who are learning, like, how to art handle and all that. And then three is, like, direct action, what we're doing now. Mm. So we're bringing everything up to the forefront. So, like, early on when I was just a peer leader, like, I would just really go to track one with Camilo, but then I would stay after for track three with Sean. And this is when we would, like, work on, like, de-escalation methods, and we would talk about a lot of things regarding, like, abolitionist mindset and, like, how to basically form it up. And then, like, so getting an opening into it, you start getting all these ideas, and I don't know, as a young person, your mind is like a sponge. So you end up, like, picking up a whole lot of information, like Amir said. So, like, you just keep being bombarded and bombarded with more stuff. And with that, like, I guess it, like, piqued my interest a lot more. So it brought me more into, like, a space where I was able, where I'm able to, like, more so clearly state, like, these, like, ideas and, these thoughts that come behind these ideas. To answer the rest of your day-to-day questions, Saturdays would be the day that I would go to the print shop. So as, like, a peer leader, like, what we would do is, it's like a student teacher. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, you're shadowing behind somebody and you're learning how to basically go through the processes of things. So when I went there, it was just me really learning how to screen print at first. Once I got the hang of it, I ended up educating like a few others that came in. So from that point on, like that was how most of my day to day was going. And then transitioning into fellowship, we were building our purpose path, and we were trying to figure out like how, like things that actually interest us, and how we could apply like these things into like our like real life, or like into like the real world. Like work, we have a set amount of hours that we have to like make up doing work along our purpose path. So we're right now, we're currently doing like portfolio workshops, so we could like build up our work, so we could be able to have like something nice to actually show people. Also like open studio hours, where you're able to come in and like create, which also like goes towards your hours too. So Saturdays I'm still at the print shop, but I'm also like shadowing behind the print supervisor. So with that, they're just basically just helping me do the tricks of the trade. And same thing as like the peer leader, like the peer leadership, it's not really been said, but I feel like I've been in the more of like the role of like taking over like the educating. Like I feel like Chrissy does teach. It's just I feel like at this point in time I've became confident, and they became confident in my skills to know that like I could bring somebody in and sufficiently teach them.
So it is, it's more of a, you are like when you become a fellow, but also throughout. I mean, there's something kind of beautiful in the term peer leader, right? That maybe peer in terms of a larger community beyond that space, but also peer leader as in like you're not really sure, you know, a leader that doesn't have to be, you know, hierarchically somewhere else in some other position.
Guy is the fact. The one who's talking about another man, not like you, who wants what you want.
Ain't no escape from a system. Buckle from birth, yeah, they don't miss them. Ain't no escape from a system. Buckle from birth, yeah, they don't miss them.
You've been indoctrinated, highly educated, about injustice being dismissed. A white world surrounded by a blue border. Thriving off green and red, yeah, these crackers orders. Seen the love, the blood, and the money. Plato y plata, threaten the honeys. If you got a dawn color skin, government will teach you you're less than them.
Ain't no escape. Ain't no escape. Ain't no escape.
I'm agitated, we've been discriminated, locked in cages, marked as misfits, pushed to the fringes of society. Check me from day one like you some higher being.
Ain't no escape from a system.